Thanks for listening to the Read Platform podcast, sponsored by Crown Peak and Elastic Puff, and hosted by me, James Kent, Paul Rogers. Look, we've put a lot of time and effort into bringing you interesting guests and great, useful content all for free. Help us keep it that way. Let other people know about the podcast so we can get some new listeners. Refer us to your friends. Repost our LinkedIn and Twitter posts. That really does help amplify our reach. And the best thing you can do is give us a rating on wherever you are listening or watching today. So let me introduce our episode and our guests, and then we'll crack on. So the topic today is how Salesforce commerce customers should approach and can approach migration from Site Genesis to more modern versions of Salesforce. And who better to talk to than one of the leading global SIs, Trizens. I've had a lot of fun over the years working on various projects, and they've got a massive amount of experience. And they're not just experienced in Salesforce as well, so they do build on other platforms, so they've got experience in migrations from other platforms to Salesforce, and also from Salesforce older versions to the newer formats. So first of all, let's introduce Shifko Rusev, who's the SVP for the Salesforce practice based over in Bulgaria, I believe. Good afternoon. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, James. Pleasure to be with you and Paul today.
Really appreciate you joining us. Do you want to give people a little bit of an introduction to who you are and what you do at Trizens?
Of course. So as I mentioned, I'm Senior Vice President of the Salesforce practice at Trizens. So I'm responsible for the technical delivery of our Salesforce projects across the globe. And I'm also leading some of the strategic investments in the Salesforce ecosystem Trizens is doing. So all the accelerators that we built and the quick starts throughout the years together with our partners at Salesforce.
Excellent, thanks. And also warm welcome to Leon Downs, who's the Director of Strategy and Success, and also background working in retail e-commerce with brands like The Body Shop, who I would imagine quite a few people have come across and shopped in. So hi, Liam, how are you? Do you want to give a bit of an intro to yourself and your role, and maybe give the people who haven't worked with Trizens before a bit of a flavor for where Trizens fits and what your expertise is?
Yep, thanks, James. So I think you've given a little bit of a headline intro to me there. So I've been with Trizens for 3 years now. So I look after all of our in-life customer strategy and success. I've got, getting on for now, kind of 17 years worth of experience working within digital in the retail space. On the other side of the fence, so having worked with many agencies like Trizens in the past, I guess my sweet spot is really around digital transformation and supporting, you know, more traditional and startup brands in terms of navigating their digital journey and then with a bigger focus on internationalization as well. More recently, at Trizens, for anyone that doesn't know us or hasn't heard of us in the past, so we're an international digital agency. We were born out of being an SI. For anyone who's been in the industry for a while will recognize that term. But we really are a technology agnostic digital agency where we're supporting customers in making the right technology choices from an end-to-end perspective and generating best-in-class customer experiences. And so what does that mean in practice? You know, we are supporting our clients in making the right technology decisions at whatever level that might be, you know, full programs of work around digital transformations down to smaller technology choices, but also working with them. And this is probably the more important piece is focusing on customer and what customer experience needs to be, expectations, how do you meet them? Because technology at the end of the day is a facilitation, a method for us to be able to deliver a best-in-class customer experience. So it's supporting our customers and bringing back to that question, I guess, in terms of what does a best-in-class customer experience look like, and how do we bring in a technology architecture and experience to deliver that? As I mentioned, we're a global agency, so we have multiple delivery centers. We have headquarters in the UK and Australia, so we're able to, and America now, so we have a big focus in the States. And so we're able to really scale our partners and clients across the globe, no matter where they are.
Great. So I'll ask the first question, and just to set the scene a little bit for listeners that maybe aren't as kind of well versed in Salesforce and the kind of ecosystem. Can you just give us a bit of an overview on what SiteGenesis is and kind of why Salesforce have kind of moved away from it and introduced additional options?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So SiteGenesis is actually the reference code application built by a company called Demandware in the past, which was acquired by Salesforce back in 2016. So this code architecture has actually gone through several iterations. So the original version of SiteGenesis was based on so-called pipelines, which are still popular across the Salesforce community, which is kind of a mixture of UML-based diagrams and server-side JavaScript code, which are being parsed by a Reno engine and transformed into a JavaScript code, which is running on the application servers of the cloud infrastructure of Salesforce. So this is the legacy kind of version of the code architecture. And then we have SiteGenesis, which was introduced in 2016. Obviously there is two newer versions. So SFRA is most probably one of the most popular one, which was introduced in 2018. So the storefront reference code architecture, which introduced a lot of improvements around mobile first experience, performance, extendability, and so on and so forth. And of course, the latest one, the composable storefront architecture, which we're going to cover most probably in a bit more details further down the conversation.
Great. And then, so the next question. So I guess I've had a number of clients that have been on Salesforce where they've been on SiteGenesis and they've been kind of pushed towards either SFRA or the composable route, which I think makes complete sense if you want to get the most out of the platform. And James and I are working with someone at the moment who are on SiteGenesis. And I guess one of the things that I don't think is necessarily clear around Salesforce is the pros and cons of actually staying on SiteGenesis. So in terms of kind of like, you know, new functionality within Salesforce and stuff like that, like obviously that might be a pro for investing in the move away from SiteGenesis. But what's your view on, as an SI partner, on how people should be thinking in this scenario? Like, is there a route forward with SiteGenesis? And what are the pros and cons of actually staying on it for a period of time pre-having the budget available?
Yeah, of course. SiteGenesis is definitely a legacy code architecture now within the Salesforce world. So there are no new releases since, I think, 2021, most probably, or early 2022 must have been the last release, which doesn't necessarily mean that you're not getting any of the new features. Obviously there are seamless platform upgrades and you get all the latest features which are available in the Salesforce Commerce Engine. Most probably for some of the front-end features that Salesforce are introducing to SFRA, you would need to do a bit of work in terms of customizing your front end. So for customers, there would be an additional work to actually benefit from everything that is being released within SFRA world, for example. Staying on SiteGenesis is still a good option for customers? I think so, yes, because you can still do pretty much everything on SiteGen. So customers can continue to improve their performance, continue to improve their customer experience, and so on and so forth. So if they have reached to the point of being limited by what they can do with the code architecture and the improvements that they can make and the agility that they have with this particular version of the architecture, then they definitely need to consider moving on to either SFRA or composable.
Crown Peak, enabling organizations to build meaningful digital experiences for everyone, everywhere. engage your customers with our content management system, reach your entire audience with our digital accessibility and quality tools, and grow your brand with our product discovery solution. Find out more at crownpeak.com.
Did that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. From my perspective, yeah, I think that's a good kind of overview leading into some of the next questions.
And I think most probably something that I missed to add is what we usually advise our clients is to try to sweat the asset as much as possible. Obviously, try to get the most of SiteGen before they consider migrating to a newer code architecture.
Mm-hmm. And I think what I'd add into that is that I think this is where the role of a good partner comes into play in a lot of the discussions that we have with our clients. And there are a lot of discussions going on at this very point around Site Genesis and what is the, you know, should we stay, should we move, you know, what are the options ahead of us? And I think a good partner will always help you navigate that, but help you understand where the benefits are, and, you know, at what point do the minimal gains that you're able to achieve with the technology become, I guess, unviable from a commercial perspective, and it requires you to make that jump in technology choices.
Yeah, I think it's good advice to give people is don't jump and invest in a big project until you fundamentally need to, and plan for that carefully, because it is a lot of effort. And often people don't sweat the assets they've invested in enough before they make a leap. Leads me on to a related question is, yeah, we all know the market's evolving in terms of technology, the tech stacks that people are using, the greater need for that interoperability and the ability to isolate and retire far more easily than used to be the legacy monolith space, which is where it would be, yeah, a couple of years before you could properly retire a system and plug other stuff in. And obviously Salesforce has made some of these moves with SFRA, with its moving to composable, and some that make retailers review and decide where they're going. I'd love to hear from your perspective, working with a lot of different businesses and different platforms, what type or size of business is best suited to those modern Salesforce solutions and why? And where do you think that sweet spot is?
Right. So what type of businesses? From my perspective, I would say that any business could actually get on board onto Salesforce Commerce, because it's most probably the best SaaS solution on the market. And of course, maybe the smaller and less digitally mature businesses will struggle to manage the platform. But still, there are a lot of tools that are actually easy to use within the platform. And even for those type of customers, it will be easier, not easier, but easy to understand how to work with the platform. So I would get that it's, I would say that it's suitable for smaller businesses as well. But certainly what we see in the market is that those businesses usually prefer other platforms like Shopify or Bitcoin. But we do have some accelerators built for those type of customers. We have managed services options to actually help them run their business and operate on the platform, which makes Salesforce suitable for them as well. Of course, we see more mid-size, and probably upper mid-size, lower enterprise customers go on to Salesforce, as well as large enterprises. So actually, that's where Salesforce strength is in those kind of two segments of the market. So, yeah, I think that will be my take on this. Liam, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think what I'd add to that is that, and again, a frequent conversation is, you know, it's not necessarily size of business, which dictates kind of that technology decision. I think it's, you know, what are your objectives and goals as a business, and how is your business structured? And I'll go into a bit more detail in that, because it really did. Salesforce really comes into its own and has a sweet spot where we have clients that have aspirations to grow on a global level. because the technology enables that really easily, and that is really a sweet spot. So when we're having conversations with new clients and existing clients on these technology decisions, if there is a priority list and priority high up on that list is internationalization and internationalization at pace with the capacity to really scale and have the configurability and functionality to scale the business equally across each market globally, that's where Salesforce's sweet spot is. It really is, because we know that we're able to build a reference architecture within Salesforce that enables that global rollout for our clients. And that's where we see the benefit and growth trajectory enabled by Salesforce for clients. I would say the other technologies in the market are catching up for sure, but the gap is still there. And that's the sweet spot for me. Is, you know, if I have a business that really wants to scale globally, and I've got a 3-year plan in place or a 5-year plan in place to be able to do that, and I have a complex business structure with various different entities spread across the globe, Salesforce does that easily. It just does it.
Elastic Path is on a mission to break through the barriers that prevent commerce leaders from delivering extraordinary shopping experiences. Both business and tech teams are able to innovate on their own terms, fully embrace composability, and in turn, never compromise on what's possible. Learn more at www.elasticpath.com.
Yeah, I can answer that point about having the reference architecture there to enable that consistent way of growing. I think I'd challenge you on the speed and say that there are platforms that are far speedier to launch internationally, but you have to take compromise with it. And I think the herein lies where what size and structure of business and how complex is it, and what appetite do you have for those compromises, and therefore having to plug in more additional things to resolve them versus having the capability in the platform. Which is always interesting why there's no such thing as a perfect platform. But one thing I'd love to dive into more about the composable stuff, actually, because everyone talks about composable, and I think a lot of time composable doesn't land with business teams because it just sounds very nebulous, even though actually it's a strategic way of thinking rather than an architectural solution, and it's about giving flexibility. And sometimes I think that message doesn't land. So what I'd love to for you guys as having a lot of knowledge and expertise around the Salesforce ecosystem is drilling into where they're going with their composable approach. Can you summarize for people who've come from that more legacy view of what was Demandware, then Site Genesis on Salesforce? How does the composable bit fundamentally differ to that? And what are the implications to an e-commerce team?
Right. So in terms of the differences, so obviously the composable storefront solution is fundamentally different because it's a different architecture. So headless / composable architecture. So headless architecture means that the front end is decoupled from the back end usually, and composable means that more of the components that we usually see kind of plugged in into the e-com engine are further decoupled. So you have multiple services which are connected to the front end through APIs. So that's the fundamental difference. So in SFRA or SiteGen, you have everything kind of stitched together in a monolith architecture. So the front end is tightly coupled to the backend, which drives its own complexity. Obviously, when you're doing changes to the backend or to the front end, you have to deploy the code together. Which means that everything needs to be planned very well upfront to ensure that there are no disruptions to business processes. Within composable, it's obviously very different. So you can have deployments across the front end, across the back end, which enables customers to innovate faster on the front end and build personalized customer experiences easier. So our customers who have migrated onto composable have actually gone from deploying every couple of weeks to deploying every day, which is a huge benefit because it's speed up the innovation. And obviously they can migrate from working primarily with a partner like Trezence or external agencies into building their own in-house development teams to enable this innovation to happen in-house, really, and to enable the brand to control this customer experience. And I think there was a bit more. Can you repeat the second part of the question?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. Actually, I've got a sub-question related to that, because one of the issues people have faced in the past on legacy version Salesforce is it does require more QA release work because of the way it's architected. So you tend to spend a bit more time getting those releases out. Is this in this commercial approach? I'm assuming then that actually from a developer point of view, there's less work on the releases and it's a speedier process to get code committed and out. Is that a fair assumption?
Absolutely. Of course, you still have those quality gates in place, but everything happens a lot quicker because you can actually focus your attention on smaller pieces of functionality introduce smaller pieces of functionality quicker. So this is the bit that actually reduces the time spent on testing. So it's not a huge release where you need to test 10, 15 features at once, which could then introduce regression issues and so on and so forth. Of course, we encourage our customers to focus on automating the whole process through unit testing, through automated functional testing, which are being executed across the different instances, just to make sure that quality is intact.
Great. And I guess the big elephant in the room around Site Genesis is the cost of migrating. So we've had, I think James and I have both worked with Salesforce brands in the past that have been quoted kind of, you know, between $500,000 and $1.5 million before you even start them thinking about new features. And I think, you know, you guys obviously work with Magento and Adobe in the past and have seen kind of what happened with the M1 and M2 migrations. And I think, you know, we've seen Salesforce has definitely seen a lot of brands kind of move away due to the cost essentially being directly comparable to a replatforming project or even sometimes higher. What makes this migration so expensive and so complex? Like, yeah, what is it that is essentially being done when you're migrating to an SFRA or going down the composable route?
If we start with SiteGen to SFRA, the cost that you have heard is not unusual, especially if we're talking about starting everything from scratch and fully migrating onto a new code architecture, which most customers prefer because they usually try to leave the technical debt that's been piling up throughout the years behind. So they want to start from a blank piece of paper and then start building up everything on a solid foundation. So that's where most probably the higher cost comes in. So it's pretty much starting everything from scratch, right? So it's pretty much moving on to a new platform. To be fair, we usually advise for that approach because there is a different path also. So you can do a gradual migration from SiteGen and SFRA, because obviously both code architectures can run simultaneously in the cloud. But this sometimes is a bit challenging because there is a fundamental difference between the code architectures. Some developers are pretty used to work with SiteGen, others with SFRA. So just running those two code architectures at once could be challenging, could lead to some unpredicted kind of behaviors on the storefront, issues that are difficult to pinpoint, and so on and so forth. So we usually advise customers to go down that road. But of course, if cost is the deciding factor, which in most cases it is, there is a path to gradual migration from SiteGen to SFRA. If we're talking about composable, I think most probably the majority of the budget gets into the fact that a lot of things are done differently between the monolith and the composable architecture. And there is a bit of investment from customers that has to be focused on making sure that everything works as it used to work before in the monolith architecture. Obviously, there are some differences around how I manage SEO, metadata, URLs, site preferences, API keys, and so on and so forth. So this is where we come in, and our accelerators that we build for customers to just to speed up that process and reduce the cost for our customers who are migrating into composable.
Great. And then Liam, I guess this one might be an interesting one for you to answer. So if you're a brand, and you've obviously worked in-house for retailers and brands in the past, and you're on Site Genesis and you're starting to look at your next move, what do you think the right approach is? Obviously, it is a considerable investment. Like, what do you think the right kind of first steps are?
Just to add on to the point that Zhivko's just made, I think the one thing that I'd add into the approach of the composable storefront, certainly to touching the front end anyway as a whole, is that it's become a lot more accessible and less cost prohibitive. And so one of the things that we're certainly starting to talk to clients about now, which plays into your second question, is that the business case is a much easier one for us to, I guess, validate with a proof of value because of the hybrid deployment process that we can go through. So we're able to build a business case around, you know, one or a few pages across the site or particular sites. So if I take the example of one particular client that we've just been launching composable storefront with, we started off by saying, let's create a proof of value for the US, which is much more accessible from a cost perspective. We're not going to go into a big full re-platform project, and we'll test it on a smaller base than going out to our entire site. And by doing that, we're able to get in quickly. We're able to get in a much lower price base. And we were then able to prove that business was able to see, okay, this is actually going to provide me value. And these are the KPIs that I'm able to impact. And we're seeing commercial value out the back of it, which then opened the door for us to be able to move the project across the rest of the architecture. I think to tackle your question kind of head on, if I'm sat on the client side today and I'm a Site Genesis customer, it really comes back to, you know, what are my objectives and what are my objectives as a business? What is my current status with Site Genesis? Do I feel, you know, going back to, you know, the original points we were making, am I getting the most out of the platform as it currently stands? Do I have, you know, the operational team in place on my side to be able to deliver it, right? Because in the scenario of moving from SiteGem to SFRA, having SFRA as a technology does not make my business perform any better. But let's be clear about that. It can enable my business to perform better, but just by switching it on does not just do that. It's not a flick of a switch. So do I have the operational capabilities to make use of all of the functionality and configurations and trade it hard to be able to squeeze the value out of it? And for the business case that it's going to take to go through a replatforming exercise to go through that, because I think that's the key for me, is, you know, how am I going to produce value out of any new types of technology? You know, if you're putting a gun to my head, I would certainly be looking to go down a composable route because of that point around it being more accessible. And I think, you know, had we been having this conversation 4 or 5 years ago around, you know, as a business, if I'm a mid-sized business, do I want to go down a composable or headless route? it would have been much less accessible. It would have been more expensive to achieve. I think that the implications that it would have on my business and my team and or cost to actually operate it, the complexities would have been much higher. Whereas now that, you know, the level of entry is much lower. And I think the KPIs that most customers are looking for in terms of around front-end performance and the ability to influence and impact the customer experience at greater velocity and frequency is greater than going down an SFRA route, as an example. So yes, I think it's a kind of a long way of saying, if I'm sat as a client today on site Genesis and I feel that I am at a point where I can no longer take that technology forward, I would certainly be looking at going down the composable storefront route.
It's a noise.
Okay, if I may jump in here. Yeah, sorry, James. I was going to say, like, going down the composable path is important if you're looking to just optimize the way you create those personalized customer experiences and obviously innovate faster. Whether you want to decouple some platform components and plug in some external systems into your architecture or do something else, that doesn't really require for you as a business to go down the composable road, because you can do that with site Genesis. So for example, if you want to plug in a headless search provider or a headless CMS provider, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to go down the composable path. So as per Liam's point, the most important consideration is what are the business priorities, right? And the business leaders who are driving digital transformations within the organizations need to define their priorities first and then tie the right technology to the priorities.
Yeah, that's really nice points. I love the fact that you focused on operational readiness, because I think the change management piece is totally underestimated in a lot of projects by client teams of, we've got great shiny new kit, but what resource-wise do we need to adapt to? What are the new processes that we should do to work more effectively? You know, what other tooling is it introducing where we might not have an expert in the business and we either need to get an external specialist or we've got to bring somebody in? So yeah, it's a really nice point, because those decisions aren't isolated. Fundamentally, they've got to happen hand in hand. It leads me nicely onto the question around, so you've, Liam, I know you said about composable, you were forced to narrow your colours to the mast, because that's more future-proofing. I know that Trisus has built a front-end accelerator for Salesforce composable solution. I think this would be a really useful time to talk people through. What is your accelerator? What does it do, and what are the benefits for Salesforce customers?
So yes, we have our Trisus Composable Storefront Accelerator, and actually when Salesforce introduced this concept of Composable Storefront, we started exploring it. That was, I think, back in 2021, most probably Q3 or Q4. And we identified quite a few gaps, which were very obvious. But I think the big one for us is the ability to manage content through the platform. So most probably Salesforce is very popular for the content management capabilities, which are built in within the platform. So and the people who are within the Salesforce space know about page designer and all the content assets and slots and the content scheduling, so on and so forth. So when Salesforce originally introduced their composable storefront, those capabilities were not kind of introduced to the decoupled front end. So we started speaking to our customers, we started speaking to prospects. So this was a big one for them. And to be honest, some of them were kind of finding this a barrier to even think about headless, you know. So because usually in headless implementations, you need to go and implement a headless CMS, for example, which we all know that could be a costly exercise. So that's why in the first iteration of our composable storefront, we actually focus on covering this large gap for our customers. What we managed to achieve is like we introduce all of the capabilities that were available within the monolith architecture. So customers have all the pages and our components that they're used to work with. They have the content scheduling. They have the personalization as well across the different pages, which was really important and actually helped us gain more visibility in the Salesforce space and be one of the very first Salesforce partners to launch composable storefront. And we were actually introduced at Dreamforce 2022 as one of four launch partners for composable storefront. Obviously, we continue to invest in and iterate further with our accelerator. So in version two, we have actually focused on three key areas as well. So the first one is to implement best-in-class UX for kind of standard integrations, which normally all customers go through just to enable the quicker time to market. So functionalities like the cookie consent messaging, like the address search, store locator, Google Tag Manager integration with GA4 setup, which proved to be quite challenging for some customers. And this all saves time and money for our customers and enable them to go faster and actually focus on the customer experience. Then the composability element as well. So we wanted to enable merchants going down the composable path to actually have some of the components decoupled from the architecture already, from the commerce engine. So like the search and merch, we partnered with Algolia. So we do have Algolia integrated into our composable storefront accelerator. And then the third focus area was continuous integration and deployment, back to our point around quality and setting a solid foundation for our customers to start innovate within a composable architecture. So we've implemented a framework and we have around 80% coverage of unit tests and front-end functional tests so that we enable our customers to actually start from the solid foundation and make sure that quality remains intact. Great. But if I have to summarize, because that's a lot of information, we were primarily focused on covering the gaps and also enabling our customers to go to market quicker with a lower investment.
Great. And that kind of leads on to the next question, which is quite, I guess, a bit related to some of the comments you've made, Liam, around particularly like the headless side of things being more accessible and, you know, a bit more like kind of widely integrated. What do you see as the kind of operational impact going down the composable route in terms of kind of capabilities in-house for a retailer or a brand? So what kind of skills and resources do you think a retailer or a brand needs if they are to invest and kind of, you know, get the most out of a composable stack?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Jivko come on to some of the technical skill sets, but I think the key one for us, and again, like this is it almost becomes an enabler, I think, in terms of bringing it in, because operationally, you can still lean on a partner like us to provide the resources to be able to run it. But I think what it enables from a skill set perspective and capability, what will then end up in making kind of key operational changes, if you like, on the client side, is that ability to manage the front end on the client side to greater effect and impact. So what we're definitely seeing is more clients moving to having kind of that front end React skill set internally, because it gives them the control over the CX element of the site. And it becomes, as you scale, it becomes more cost effective. Certainly if you are running multiple, you know, personalization streams with multiple testing streams and you're wanting to make lots of change at a high velocity, it makes sense to bring that resource in-house. and have that skill set available to you. And that's certainly where we're seeing the biggest operational changes, where, you know, in the world of Monolith, you would need a Salesforce developer with your SI who would be managing that workload. In most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, we're certainly seeing that shift out now, where clients are looking to bring that resource in-house. Z, for, I guess, from a technical operational side, there will be other bits, but certainly from my perspective, that's the main shift that we're seeing across clients.
Yeah. So from technical point of view, as I mentioned, Lynn, so certainly the skills that are required are in the React Osprey space. So our customers are started looking for React developers to bring in house. And back to my point, are there, like, this enables them to change their relationship with the vendor. So obviously do more things in house and decrease kind of the dependency on the service integrator or the digital agency. Like we see how those engagements change across our client base. So people rely on us more for the Salesforce skills rather than the front end skills currently, just because they can now acquire those skills and build an in-house development team. Because the pool of developers is definitely larger. While the Salesforce skills are still required, those niche skills are usually found across the mm-hmm. partners. And in terms of operational, most probably what our clients usually need are strong product owners or product managers who do understand how the architecture changes with Composable and how the front end interacts with the back end and the APIs and all the changes that are happening across the tech stack and the integrations because of the fact that you're migrating on the Composable architecture. So that's really important because they can actually make decisions and plan features and functionalities better because they actually understand what needs to come first from the back end and so that the front end could be built on a later stage and done by the in-house development team. In terms of the support on monitoring and maintenance, things are changing as well, but that's where we usually step in to support our customers to ensure that they continue monitoring the performance of the front end and back end as they used to previously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point, Z. I think is that product owner role definitely needs to have the understanding and experience of the new architecture, so that they're able to support the strategic direction of the product and the architecture. I think that's the key one because they're going to be leading that roadmap and working with a partner like us to drive that. And the architecture is quite different. And the technology is different, and the focus areas for them will be different. So, having, I guess, the training in place to either elevate existing teams to be able to take that on, or to bring different resource in that has that skill set and capability is key.
Cool, excellent. That's been really useful. I've really enjoyed listening to your perspective because obviously you work with a lot of different businesses who come at this with different perspectives and different business needs. So it's always interesting to hear the SI view. There's a lot of people out there in the Salesforce world, Salesforce merchants at various stages of maturity or various stages of their project life cycles. If they want to reach out and probe on any of this, or if they've got a potential project challenge they want to throw at you, how do they reach out?
We have a website. You won't be surprised to hear. So, There are contact forms on the website that you can use, or you can get in contact with either Zhipko or myself via LinkedIn, and we'll be able to support with any questions. We have a sales team, so Paul Green in the UK, who will pick up any of those questions. But ultimately, to reach out in all of the normal channels, either via the website, LinkedIn, we'll share all of our contact details with you guys. So if anyone wants to come direct to you, feel free to pass on our details, and we're more than happy to to have a conversation, coffee, lunch, dinner, beers, whatever's on the menu for anyone that wants to kind of pick our brains.
Excellent. Yeah, I'd like all of those. That sounds good. No, that's good.
Absolutely. I was going to say that we are available at any point in time. So we would love to have a chat only. That's what it takes. So we're happy to consult people on their composable strategy and general strategy as well.
Cool.
And obviously, we said at the start, we're an international business. So anyone in the US that wants to kind of pick up with the US team or anyone kind of in Australia who wants to pick up down there, we'd direct them in their direction.
Perfect. And anyone who's listening in, on the landing page on the website, there will be links to both Shivko and Liam's LinkedIn profiles, so don't worry. And look, thanks everyone for listening. I hope you found it useful. Do pass it on to anyone else, you know, who's in the Salesforce community, anyone else who's emerging using Salesforce will find this interesting and useful. And don't forget to give us that rating on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever else you might be listening. Take care, everybody. See you all next week. For more information on this topic, head over to replatform.fm for our audio podcasts. To discuss a project, or if you'd like to chat about any of the topics covered in this episode in more detail, please reach out to myself, James Gerd, or my co-host, Paul Rogers, via LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and keep your ears peeled for the next episode.